We had last time gotten to the point that the late Victorian period saw the emergence of Jesus into works of literature. And I had told you about the first of it, and I remember to bring it this time. This is a lovely little book by Ingram called The Prince of the House of David, 1855, an epistolary novel in letters in which Jesus is simply described, not a character. But in 1880, General Lew Wallace wrote Ben-Hur, A Tale of the Christ. Now, in the Muscular Christianity lecture, either today or on Wednesday, I'm going to tell you a little bit more about Ben-Hur. But right now, this is all I want to say about it. This novel that put Jesus into fiction as a character. He even speaks, not a lot, but when he speaks, it's important. It's a turning point in evangelical Christians' attitude toward novels. Hundreds of thousands of people read Ben-Hur, and in so doing, for the first time, read a novel. It legitimated the exercise of reading literature. For hundreds of thousands of people. I told you last time that this book was central in the creation of the Christmas narrative that's still in our hard drive. And we're going to talk a little bit next time, either today or next time, about Lew Wallace's Jesus and who he is as an example in muscular Christianity. But right now, I want to turn to two Victorian lives of Jesus. In the latter half of the 19th century, the quest for the historical Jesus became a subject of literary works and biographical works. The life of Jesus began to be treated not only in novels like Ben-Hur, but writers also began to write biographies, lives of Jesus. It is, in fact, one of the contributions of Victorian Christianity, the Victorian lives of Jesus, making the life of Jesus itself a subject of biography. In this doing this, kiddos, writers take Jesus out of the Word being the Bible, and put him into the world of human literary production. And they legitimate the act of people using their imaginations and manipulating, working with the life and ministry of Jesus. Now, traditionalists at first didn't like that because they believed that the Word, the gospel narratives, told us all that we needed to know about Jesus. He doesn't need to be the subject of human imaginations. Now, the first important life of Jesus in the Victorian period is, in fact, not Anglo-Saxon. It is French. And for those of you who are interested in Dr. White's studies and all this stuff that White studies, all of you have to read Ernst Renan's La Vie de Christ, The Life of Jesus by Ernst Renan. R-E-N-A-N, The Life of Jesus. Ernest. It was published in 1863 and was written at the early stages of the modern quest for the historical Jesus. Renan's Life of Jesus is universally regarded as a literary masterpiece, if nothing else. But it was a scandalous piece for Orthodox Christians because it was not written from a belief perspective. Renan wrote the life of Jesus, saying that he did not accept the miracles of Jesus, and instead recommended what he called a mythological approach to the life of Jesus, a mythological approach. But with a twist, a mythological approach that was deeply informed by a very rich understanding and deep knowledge of the Holy Land and ancient Israel and its customs. And he believed that by situating Jesus in his own culture, and by knowing all we can about it, and by using our literary imaginations, we can come to understand all that is important about this great man. Very controversial. Now, a few years after that, in the 1870s, Henry Ward Beecher, in his Plymouth Church, and we've already talked about Beecher a little bit, began to preach a series of Sunday night sermons in which he inaugurated a new kind of sermon. Not one in which he took a text and developed all of these theological points, but one in which he sort of talked to his audience in a less formal way. And he began to give a series of lessons, really, on the life of Jesus. And in 1875, he published this book, The Life and Jesus the Christ. Isn't this a beautiful book? It becomes a kind of a cultural artifact itself. Very expensive. Guiltier on here. This tells people, among other things, that you can afford to own this book, right? The Life of Jesus the Christ. Beecher's Life of Jesus is not a straightforward narrative of Jesus' life. He doesn't intend to have, or he doesn't pretend to have, a complete account of the life of Jesus. It's more like a meditation on the life of Jesus. He'll make an observation about Jesus' life, and then he will kind of sit back and meditate on it for you. And he will ask his readers to, and folks, the word is everywhere in this book, ask you to imagine. And folks, for a long time, evangelical Christians were afraid of letting anybody imagining any things, right? Authority often is afraid to let people know. Let's imagine about Jesus. It's a democratic time. For instance, he refers often to Jesus spending lonely times by himself. I suspect that's one of the things that was attractive to Henry Ward Beecher, who was never by himself. He was a great celebrity. But Jesus in the Gospels is represented constantly as wanting to go away, right? Go away. Sometimes he will just miraculously disappear, right? To be alone, to gather his strength. He would spend lonely nights praying alone. Of this, Henry Ward Beecher said, there is no part of Jesus that stirs the imagination more profoundly than these solitary nights in lonely places spent in prayer. Then he's off, asking you to imagine with him what it was like to have been with Jesus. Folks, what he's doing, he's asking you to join him in establishing an intimate connection with Jesus' interior life. Connect your interior life with Jesus's interior life. Beecher conceived of his project as a widely accessible educational venture. He intends to instruct as well as to inspire. And one of the things he says in the first is that he teaches you about this new thing called the quest for the historical Jesus. Gives you a little seminar in it at first. It's actually pretty good. Now, important point. He accepts that the Gospels were written by men called Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. He is an Orthodox Christian at this point. He says these Gospels are for inspired lives. He says that two of them are written by, quote, disciples who were eyewitnesses of the events recorded. Who would that be? Matthew and John. And two were written by men who were companions of the apostles and derived their materials in part from them. Luke and Mark. But he warned, they don't agree with each other. They're disagreeing constantly. He accepts that up front. It is for him just to be accepted. You just have to accept it. And he says, it doesn't make any sense to try to harmonize them, mix them all up and get a true picture. They're just too contradictory, he said. So be it. You cannot harmonize the Gospels. Therefore, he says, rejoice. We are at liberty to do what? Make up our own. We are, he feels then, at liberty to select such other as would best help the general impression. Pick and choose. And why does he want to do that? He wants to lead you in constructing from these four Gospels your own individual fifth Gospel. The Gospel according to Katie. Or to Stephanie. And he says, no one is better qualified to lead that than Henry Ward Beecher. And because we're modern people, we have all of these aids now, scholarly aids, to learn about the Holy Land and about Jesus. So here we go. So the life then is Henry Ward Beecher's attempt to create a fifth gospel for his readers. This is sort of Henry Ward Beecher's life. Now you model on your own. He wants to depict Jesus' life, his social relations, his dispositions, his deeds, and his doctrines. Why? He hopes that the book will carry its readers into the richest blessings which I can imagine. And what is the richest blessing I can imagine? Here we go. A sympathetic insight into the heart of its great subject, Jesus Christ, the Redeemer of the world, and a vital union with him. I say it again. He wants to carry his readers into the richest blessings which I can imagine. A sympathetic insight into the heart of its great subject, Jesus Christ, the Redeemer of the world, and a vital union with him. Is he trying to save your soul? Does he say anything about being forgiven for sin? No, this is Henry Ward Beecher, liberal. But he wants you to have a vital, sympathetic heart union with the man named Jesus, and everybody will be better for it then. The book reflects Henry Ward Beecher's liberal thinking about things like evolution and the desirability of change and progress, becoming, and all of those late 19th century words. Now, but over evolution, there's always truth. Truth, he says, quote, remains the same. But every age has its own style of thought. And the preacher then must, here we go, readapt truth from age to men's ever-renewing thoughts. as men change and are, I like this, renewed. The gospel must change, and the preachers of the gospels must change the ways in which it is proclaimed. As I have said, unlike Ernst Renan, he accepts the gospel accounts as true. They are, quote, a collection of veritable historical documents with the record of miracles and with the train of spiritual phenomenon as of absolute and literal truth. This train of spiritual phenomena is of absolute and literal truth. Is that good enough for you? Is that firm enough for you? The miraculous element constitutes the very nerve center of the gospel. The miracles are the nerve center of the gospels. You can't explain them, but they are the center of the gospel. But having said that, in his own fifth gospel, he records almost none of them, because they really aren't at the center of his gospel. They may be at the center of the four gospels. They're not at the center of his gospel. Because, he says, Christ's greatest miracles were wrought, made, guess where? Within himself. His noble and sinless lives are the true miracles, says he. Henry Ward Beecher prided himself on being a modern man, and he said, modern people can't believe in the literal verbal inspiration of every word of the gospel, of the Bible. You cannot believe that Moses wrote all five books of the Bible if one of them at the end of it describes his what? Death. You cannot literally believe that the sun can stand still no matter how long Joshua holds up his hands. The theory of verbal inspiration, he says, brings a strain upon the Word of God which it cannot bear. Realistic statement about the realities of his time. People who insist on the verbal inspiration are causing people to scorn the Bible because it simply can't be defended in our scientific times, says he. He says Jesus came to earth to be a man and succeeded so perfectly that he seemed to his own age and to his followers to be only a man. He came to earth to be a man and succeeded so perfectly that he seemed to his own age and his followers to be only a man. But he wasn't. He was also God. And at his baptism, Henry Ward Beecher says, the man named Jesus also became what? The Christ. Also became the Christ. He said, Jesus was not a man striving to rise to the deity. He wasn't this way shower of liberal religion, of like Christian Science and things. He was the Son of God. He was already divine. He was God in flesh. And guess what? He knew it. This is interesting. He knew it. He always knew it. It's actually very orthodox. And because he knew it, he always had to, quote, restrain his divinity within such bounds as should identify him with his brethren and keep him within the range of their personal sympathy. What if he always began to act like the Son of God all the time? That's kind of spooky. I'm living with God. Humans don't do that very well, I suspect. So he says, he has to remain just enough a human so they can retain their sympathy. Folks, that's that great romantic Victorian idea to establish sympathy, soul communion with somebody. The disciples are virtually absent, almost literally absent from the life. But someone you wouldn't expect is right in the middle of it. Right in the middle of this Protestant life of Jesus is, guess who? Mary. Hello? Mary. Actually, he says, we have gone too far in rejecting the Catholic veneration of Mary. We need to go back to the scriptures, he says, and recapture the central role that the mother played in her son's life. And in that life, he says, the family and the home are central. Now, I submit to you, young people, that it is hard to make family central to the life of Jesus, who never married, who had no family, who sassed his mama at the wedding at Canaan and told his disciples, if they really want to follow him, what must they do? Leave your mother and father. Suck it up. But he says, there's just enough. He says, he began his mission to others by going home to his mother. And in fact, one of the Gospels does say that. Before he began the ministry, he left and went and spent some time with Mary. Beecher says, the household was his first temple. It was the opening of a wedded life engaged his first sympathy. The opening of a wedded life, that's a fancy way of just saying a wedding. A wedding engaged his first sympathy, is that word again, and the promotion of social and domestic happiness was the inspiration of his first miracle. Folks, that's about all you can say about it, though. Through the household as through a gate, he says, Jesus entered upon his ministry of love. The second life of Jesus is this book by Edward Eggleston. You will notice that they are companion volumes, that they are published by the same New York publisher. Folks, this really is good, solid Victorian middle-class culture. One of the ways you would set yourself apart as a middle-class person would be able to stock your library with these kinds of books. Christ in the Arts. The late 19th century saw a huge explosion of artistic representations of Jesus. And for the first time, a great many of them were Protestant. And there were several occasions in the late Victorian period in which men produced lavishly illustrated lives of Jesus. They were intended to decorate Victorian parlors, and as I've said, they were intended to be an emblem of middle-class success and spirituality. The most important of these was published in 1874 by the same New York City publisher that was going to publish Beecher's Life of Jesus the Christ. And it was put together by a layman from Indiana who late in his life became a minister, a Methodist minister, Edward Eggleston. He wrote a sort of compendium from the Gospels of the life of Jesus, and he illustrated them with pictures by a French engraver called Bida. Here is the book. Here is the frontispiece, Christ in Art. Alexandra Bida. The story of the words and acts of Jesus Christ as related in the language of the four evangelists arranged in one continuous narrative. What do we call that? It's a harmony of the Gospels, the one that Henry Ward Beecher said, don't waste your time with. Illustrated by Bida and also containing some American artists. Recognize that picture? Some of you who saw the afternoon lecture recognize that. This is Jesus alone, folks. It's actually a very important trope in late Victorian art. And here are illustrations of just flowers, flora and fauna that you can find in the Holy Land to increase your knowledge of Jesus's life. Folks, this also is one way to authenticate the life of Jesus. If you can put the life of Jesus into some sort of cultural context about which every fact you use is true and authentic, you can suggest that your narrative is also authentic. Authentication. Here's infancy and early life of Jesus illustrated again by fauna. Flora, I guess that is, isn't it? And what are these people doing? What are you learning here? Can you see what those guys are doing? They're kind of thrashing wheat, I think, or something like that. Yeah, they're being farmers. How about just learning what the shoes look like? This is realism, folks. And here then come the art. Continuing to program that hard drive, calling St. Matthew, the Sermon on the Mount, the woman healed by touching the garment of Jesus Christ, Jesus walking on water. You will find that it's going to be a lot easier to represent, to draw Jesus walking on water than it is to represent it in a movie picture. Here is the Good Samaritan at the end, the return of the prodigal son, the raising of Lazarus, the Lord's Supper, Judas and the soldiers, going forth to Calvary, the crucifixion, the resurrection, and the Christ. Any questions? Alrighty, we want to turn now to Jesus and muscular Christianity. Folks, if there is one adjective that in my mind mark late Victorian descriptions of religion and religious aspirations, it is manly. In the late 19th century, there is a concerted effort in Anglo-American Protestantism to continue to find a more manly, more masculine Jesus. And you know this in part from Professor Morgan. There was a revolt in the strenuous age of the Victorian period against the feminization of religion in Victorian America. You know that already. What hasn't been said yet is that one of the reasons for that, of course, is the Civil War. The Civil War had been won by the exertions of hundreds of thousands of brave, manly soldiers. Hundreds of thousands of whom had died. The Darwinian world valorized masculine virtues of ambition and will, even greed, in the dominant male public sphere. And lots and lots and lots and lots of Christians, conservatives and liberals, began to believe that if American religion were to succeed in this world, it too had to be masculine. And if religion has to be masculine, so does Jesus. This is epitomized in part by the creation of a new form of Christianity called the Young Men's Christian Association. It is, in fact, a British import. It was established in the 1850s by a man named Sir George Williams. Once again, lots of face fuzz and just a little plump. The why? First in England and then in the northern part of the United States, was intended to protect new young men in that new frontier of two new front. The city, the frontier of the city. When you move from your little town or farm to the city, the Y was there to do all kinds of things for you, to help you find a place to stay, a good Christian place to stay, to give you good Christian entertainment, to give you a place to hang out and to read good literature, to learn a skill, to find a job, and over again, to exercise your sorry body. This is another thing that everyone knows. I don't know why. Folks, what sport was created by someone in the Y? Basketball. How many of you knew the answer to that question? Ah, slipping away. Folks, wasn't hard to... I wonder why it took them so long. What do you got to do to play basketball? What do you got to have? A peach basket without... Take the bottom out of a peach basket and a ball. Got it, right? That's what it was. Here's an exercise class in London in 1888. Folks, what's the first thing you think you notice when you see that picture? First impression. What is it? Military. Good for you. They're all doing what? They're all doing the same thing. They're exercising. I'm not quite sure what they're... Can anyone tell me what they're doing? They're just kind of, you know... And here, in fact, is basketball. This is a Y basketball team in Florida in 1916. Now, in this masculine world, Jesus changes. Now, how many of you thought... Now, this, I can't ask this question without making it sound like I want an answer, because I do, obviously. Dr. Morgan showed you a picture of Jesus. I forgot to put it up. A picture of Jesus. Remember? That kind of, what you call it, Cro-Magnon Jesus? All righty. Did you think that guy looked particularly masculine? You know, in comparison to the beefed up Jesuses that I'm going to show you later in the late 20th century, this guy's not beefed up at all, I don't think. I think that we don't look there. I don't think that the representations of Jesus are where we look. I think that the representations that we're accustomed to are too strong to change. But other things do change, and literature is one of them. And I'm going to tell you about my book now. Ben-Hur, A Tale of the Christ, written by General Lew Wallace. Now, I do not expect you to know the plot of Ben-Hur at all. How many of you said you had seen the movie, the 59 movie? You know, even if you've seen that, you don't know the real story that's in the book. Suffice it to say that Ben-Hur is the story of betrayal. One young man is betrayed by another, a friend, a very close friend. Judah Ben-Hur is betrayed by his friend Messala, M-E-S-S-A-L-A, if you're a Roman, if you're counting. He's betrayed. He gets sent to the galleys. His mother and his sister get sent to a prison. In prison, they become lepers. In the galley, Ben-Hur becomes Charlton Heston. He becomes very beefed up. Folks, he rose for 3 years, and he becomes a very beefy man. And at a particularly important moment, he saves the life of Quintus Arius, the doomvir, the tribune who commands his ship. And guess what happens? He becomes the adopted son of this man. Now, Judah Ben-Hur is already rich back in his homeland. Now he becomes doubly rich. By the way, Ben-Hur is a story of its time. In the galleys, Quintus Aureus and Judah Ben-Hur established something of a kind of strange relationship. And the Roman senses the power and the goodness of the young Jew. And at an important point, he tells the guy who puts the chains on when the battles begin, tells them to don't put the chains on this guy. And of course, that's the battle in which, guess what happens? The ship is destroyed. Quintus Aureus gets thrown over, and guess who saves his life? Folks, this is straight out of a short story by a writer, an American writer, whose name is associated with the Gilded Age. Can you tell me who that is? Horatio Alger. Have you ever heard the name Horatio Alger? All righty. In the stories of Horatio Alger, very short, didactic little sermons, actually, some good kid does a good thing. Turns out, and that good thing is usually done to the richest man in the world. It turns out sometimes, very often, that he jumps overboard and saves the little girl, the little daughter or son of a very rich man. And in gratitude, what does that very rich man do? Makes them very rich? No. What does he do instead in this competitive world of capitalism? Gives them a what? A job. Make sure he has a skill so then he can become what? Rich. We don't give anything to Americans. You have to work. And they become very rich and very, very good. Alrighty? Now, Judah becomes the son of this man. And then he goes back to the Holy Land to find his mother and his sister and to destroy Masala. And where does he destroy? Where does he destroy Masala? In the chariot race, the great chariot race. In the novel, by the way, Masala does not die. And then the last part of the novel, then, is taken up by Judah's search for his mother and his sister. And that search takes him into the orbit of a man he has already met one time before. Jesus. He met him before. Lew Wallace, in this book, invents a chapter in the life of Jesus. And in the late 19th century, many, many people thought that it was in the Bible. Can anyone tell me, and this is in the movie, can anyone tell me what the meeting between Judah and Jesus is that he invents? Yes. On the way to the galleys, the little slave caravan stops at the well in Nazareth, and he gives him a drink. Jesus gives him a drink of water, and he looks into his eyes, and Judah is never the same. Simply looking into the young boy Jesus' eyes begins the conversion of Judah Ben-Hur. He meets Jesus again, and he becomes kind of a disciple. Actually, for 2 years. He also raises with his money from being this rich Roman and the money he already had and the money he wins from Masala and the bets. He's the richest subject in the world. Capitalistic dream. The hero of this novel becomes the richest man, not an emperor, in the world. Remember that. Okay? And we find out about Jesus through Judah Ben-Hur's reporting the ministry of Jesus, kind of like that epistolary novel. And he becomes kind of a witness for Jesus. Until finally, at the end of the novel, through a whole set of kind of strange circumstances, Jesus heals on Palm Sunday, meets and heals the mother and sister of Ben-Hur. Judah witnesses it and continues then to begin to believe more and more that Jesus is the Son of God. He has all of these troops ready to save Jesus when he gets arrested. Lew Wallace takes Judah to the Garden of Gethsemane. He comes up to Jesus as he's been taken away and asks him, "Master, if we raise an army, will you help? Will you accept our help?" Jesus doesn't answer. Jesus is already gone from us. And then the Roman soldiers try to grab Ben-Hur and arrest him with Jesus because he's a follower. And for the second time then, Lew Wallace creates a chapter in the life of Jesus. In the scripture accounts, in one of the scripture accounts in Mark, there is a young man involved in the garden episode. What happens to this young man? Can anyone tell me? No, that's not a young man. That's Peter. Peter cuts off the ear. He is grabbed. And what, Jordan, someone grabs his clothes. It's just a tunic. What happens? He runs off naked. In this novel, he makes Judah Ben-Hur that young man. Folks, this is at a time when people were saying every word of the scriptures is literally true. And Roy Beecher says, no, they're not. And Lew Wallace says, of course they're not. And I am going to invent a chapter. All righty? Then, at Calvary, all of them come together, the healed women, and Judah is converted to belief in Christianity.